In this series of Vulcan Knowledge, we've talked a lot about education, storytelling, communication, but there's also an aspect of training our geoscientists for the next generation and making sure they're not just good as researchers, but also good communicators and also community leaders. And so I'm delighted today to welcome Sharon Backhouse, the director of the GeoTenerife Training and Research Program based in the Canary Islands. But today you're joining us from the UK. Hi, Sharon. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for inviting me on. Pleasure to be here.
No, thank you so much. I've followed your work for a number of years. And honestly, I'm also quite jealous myself that I've never been able to come over to the Canary Islands to participate in this program. And it's only grown across the years. So it'd be great, first of all, to hear a little bit about yourself, your background, and then we can delve into exactly what GeoTenerife actually is.
Well, first up, I'm not a scientist. I think it's important to say that right up front. I'm actually a journalist by training, so I spent 20 years as a journalist. And I moved to the Canary Islands. I have a deep love of the Canary Islands. And it just struck me when I moved there that people would visit the Canary Islands and maybe only see the same two or three sites. And it's an extraordinary place. We call the Canary Islands like this sort of natural island classroom, lots of biodiversity. And the diversity of the geology is incredible as well. And incredibly, to this date, you still can't study a degree in geology there. So that's something we're sort of beating the drum for because we think it's the most incredible place to go and study. So we set up GeoTenerife. And actually, there was a fair bit of resistance in the early days because the authorities didn't want to be talking about the Canary Islands as a volcanic destination because they were afraid that it would affect tourism. And our viewpoint has always been, first of all, it is a volcanic destination. Can't escape that. We also have a responsibility to talk about it, but also to talk about it with the people. And we felt the right messages just weren't getting through. So I think over the last few years, we started running field trips and then training programs. And now we've delved very heavily into science communication. We've been welcoming students from all over the world these last 10 years for our training camps. We run various camps throughout the year. And we have scholarship programs to enable students to participate because obviously we don't receive public funding, which is great in the fact that it gives us a lot of freedom, but also it means that we have to sort of work hard to do what we do, which means we have to be very targeted. And the thing that really struck me, Sam, is that so many of our students come from risk areas and people just weren't talking about it. They weren't being given the tools to talk about it. So we really want to enable these scientists to become more confident, to talk about their research, to delve into areas they're passionate about. We support them as much as we can, but we want to give them the tools in terms of science communication as well so that they can then spread that message because we haven't been very good about that in the past and really crossing those boundaries between science and the people. And that's so important because if science just stays locked in a room or in a paper or in a conference, you know, it doesn't sort of do everything it needs to do. And science exactly. Is awesome. You know, yes. We want to know more about what you guys do. Just speak our language a bit more.
Exactly. And it's particularly, you know, for doing it somewhere where it is volcanically active, these people coming from risk areas, those are the people that you want to train up to go back to their communities, where they're from, where they've grown up, to be able to share their knowledge.
So absolutely.
Absolutely.
And also volcanology is a very small family, really, globally. It's not a huge discipline, which means students that we've had sort of 8 years ago are suddenly now doing some really interesting stuff. And we still act like a bit of a family. You know, people are in touch. We've had students in the US who've had problems getting into post-grad programs and sort of put them in touch with earlier researchers. And it's just really nice. There's that sort of link, that golden thread that goes through, and they all take this love of the Canary Islands home with them, which is what we love to impart because we just think they are glorious, glorious islands which aren't being properly protected yet and people don't know enough about yet. So that's what we're trying to do.
Amazing. I was actually going to ask exactly that. Do you, you know, keep in touch with your alumni essentially and see what they're up to and help them in, you know, applying for applications? Because I know a number of people who have come through, say, our graduate programs ourselves who have just either finished their courses and gone on to GeoTenerife and then gone on to other things, or they've come to us straight after a summer of doing it and they can't speak highly enough of it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's absolutely, you know, it's not just about the month or the period of time that they're with us in Tenerife. We stay in touch with them going forwards. And for me, it's an absolute joy. I feel like I'm the sort of mother hen of a growing family and I'm so proud of them, you know, and everything they do. And what's incredible is that the month that we're with us, It is about the science training, but it's about other things as well. And sometimes they might be a little bit underconfident. So they just need a little bit of, you know, support in finding their science voice in terms of communication, or they might not have traveled outside of their country of origin. So, you know, there's lots of different issues that they're dealing with. And this whole business of dealing with it, it's hard work, I'll tell you. They don't come on holiday, that's for sure. And I'm sure they've told you that as well, Sam. You know, we get through a lot in the month. But it's very much a nurturing environment where we just want them to be the best that they can be. It's just wonderful to see where they go going forward. So, I mean, one of our earlier students was Ailsa Nailsmith, who's with you, I know, in Bristol now, and Ben as well, Ben Ireland, and they're doing extraordinary work, you know, and it just makes me so proud. And then, of course, you go to various conferences and you come across them and you hear what they're doing, and I just think it's really, really lovely, really lovely. And because we're small, we can keep that sort of intimate feel to it. We don't have any aspiration to be a big multinational or turning over massive numbers. You know, we're passionate about what we do. We want to do it well, and we want to keep it small and targeted so that we can do the best that we can.
Yeah, and it's not really something conducive to opening up to 100 people anyway, but it's wonderful that you've got that balance of, you know, training them in scientific, analytical research skills, but also communication and personal skills as well. You know, finding your voice, being able to present, to be able to talk about scientific topics at a lay level as well. So it's wonderful you're able to provide almost that kind of pastoral training that a lot of researchers don't always get through the academic circles.
Yeah, and I think it's because we come at it from a completely different angle, because we're not scientists ourselves, but we put the right people in the room together to then do something special. And we're very grateful as well to all the experts who come and collaborate with us. So we have some incredible researchers who come. So this summer, we had a huge range of experts coming, from Andy Ridgway and Hannah Little, who did all the science communication training, to Dr. Rich Brown from Durham. We had professors coming across from Florida University who were doing some really exciting new research in La Palma, you know, and all of this sort of adds into the mix. And it's a really intense but real bubbling cauldron of lots of different connections and contacts. And a lot of our students have then gone on and done incredible things because of the connections they've made on the program. And one of the things I would say is that part of the reason that we set up GeoTenerife as well was also to recognize some incredible science that was being done on the island, but wasn't having a repercussion outside of the Canary Islands. So we really wanted to be that sort of contact connection point. So now, for example, we collaborate a lot with the Oceanographic Institute, with IGN, with various other institutions and local experts. And that means that they then get an opportunity to sort of cross-pollinate, if you like, with other experts and students and institutions. And that's led to a growing number of collaborations and PhDs and lots of things. So that's super exciting. Yeah. So it's a bit different.
Yeah. And of course, it's evolved a lot in even just the past 2 years. So let's kind of split those two apart now. And let's talk about pre-La Palma eruption in 2021. So for GeoTenerife, what would, you know, your regular kind of month look like from boots on the ground? What kind of things are you getting involved in? Because you've said, you know, you have a range of different collaborators and experts come in. So, you know, over the course of those 4 weeks, what would a normal program maybe kind of look like? Or how did it used to look like, maybe?
Well, I think in the early days, we had a different collaboration, as you know, which we did for about 8 years. But we grew increasingly frustrated with that because we didn't have a lot of lateral range of movement, if you like. I think the interest there is they just wanted students to come in and just take samples for a month. And that's not what I felt was most beneficial to the student. And I didn't think that was the right way of going about things. So the natural break came actually during COVID. And COVID was a really interesting time because obviously in 2020, everything stopped in terms of field trips. So we had to reinvent ourselves. We're a small company. We couldn't just shut our doors and not do anything for a year. So we reinvented ourselves by running virtual field trips because obviously we had experts on the ground. All the students at their home universities were actually logging in from their bedrooms, but we could still run field trips, and we produced videos and high quality photographs and lots of materials that they could use to do all the work that they'd have done on the ground, but virtually, which was really interesting. And we were very grateful to all the universities who supported us through that so that we could come out the other end. And then when we came out the other end, we realized we had an opportunity to do things differently. And we just decided just to try to build programs that we really believed in. And we're not afraid of criticism. Every year we ask our students to give us feedback and we encourage them to be honest because we're not precious. We're not here to prove anything to anybody. We're trying to be the best that we can. And it's actually thanks to that feedback that then we get better. So it's allowed us to move in lots of different directions now. So even, you know, the first year they came back was 2021 and actually universities weren't traveling then. And that actually made me quite angry because I thought we weren't doing enough to enable students to still access the high quality education that they deserved. And because we run our own field trip center, we were able to run a course in the Canary Islands in a bubble, if you like. So all the students came into the field trip center. We were all taking tests twice a week. I mean, it was a nightmare in some respects, but it meant that they could come out and actually train with us. And of course, then we had the eruption in the pond.
Yeah, so you were ready to get first training program back on the ground, back in the field, and you were thrown a complete curveball, literally right in the middle of the training program. Right, was it 1 or 2 weeks in, if that?
Yeah, it was. I think it was by week three. Yeah, because it was it's the 19th of September, and it was extraordinary because again we felt we sat down and we thought, how can we be helpful in this situation? There's obviously a lot of scientists trying to get into the exclusion zone and doing their measurements, which is, you know, absolutely right. But as a journalist, I guess my instincts kicked in and I just felt there was a lot that wasn't being looked at, studied, recorded outside of the exclusion zone. And from there, we sort of started concentrating more on the impacts rather than the natural hazard, and particularly around communication, because there was a lot of stuff just going mad on social media. The people were stressed. There was a lot of mistrust. There's an element of competition in science, which was particularly unhelpful at the time of an emergency, because what people want is a clear voice and a clear message, you know. And there were things that happened which were particularly unhelpful. So those are things that we've tried to address. So we've spent the last 2 years spending a lot of time in La Palma. We've been sort of sitting in people's homes following the recovery. We started our project Volcano Stories, because again, my other pet hate is how science is kept behind paywalls. You know, why are we paying these massive institutions to do research to then publish something which is behind a paywall? I can't get my head around that. So everything that we do is absolutely open access. And we want to provide tools for people to do better research and to ask the right questions in a different way. So Volcano Story started very humbly. We were just, you know, I had my iPhone and I couldn't believe everything I was seeing around me. You know, La Palma's a small island and suddenly everybody seemed to be on La Palma one way or the other. And I just started interviewing people on my phone. And I said to Ben, who was with us actually on that program, Ben Island, I said, we're going to make a documentary. And that's how it started. Because again, a lot of the things that we were seeing weren't being reflected in everything that was coming out the other side. And I wanted these stories to be kept, to be, you know, recorded for posterity, but also to be heard. And there were some amazing images that were being taken of the volcano, but no context around it. You know, the news seemed to be very much around, oh, this man is crying because blah, 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 you know, but not really getting into the nitty gritty of what had actually happened. So we started researching all of that, recording all of that as best we can. And the distillation of that became a film, because I thought the best way of actually getting some of these messages out and for it to be useful in other territories is to make a film. So that's what we did. We made Lava Bombs, which was quite an adventure for sure.
Yes. I can imagine. So it really, really took a turn that year. And it also opened up other opportunities for you to look at a new program, which is your marine science camp, because of the way the La Palma eruption then became essentially a coastal eruption. There was a lava delta. There was additional hazards and problems that were created from lava flows going into the ocean. And so was that kind of the incentive to almost create something new, or was it something you'd maybe already thought about in the past? Because obviously 12 years ago was the El Hierro eruption just over on the neighboring island. So that interest has always been there in terms of volcanism in the oceans around the Canary Islands, but I imagine it wasn't brought back to the forefront until 2021 from the La Palma eruption.
Yeah, I think what was interesting is because we did the movie, we met and spent a lot of time with people who perhaps we hadn't spent that much time with beforehand. And so when I met Eugenio Fay-Lenuez, this extraordinary researcher from the Oceanographic Institute, we hadn't actually met before because that, although I'd met people from the Oceanographic Institute before, it wasn't something we'd spent a lot of time sort of thinking about, really. And when I met him, it was just extraordinary. I thought he was the most incredible human being. And all of our programs are built around people. For me, the key to everything is people. You know, if we bring people to Tenerife to teach, it's not just because they do good research, it's because they're amazing at being passionate and you know, really able to share that and infuse the students and get them to love everything that they do and want to pursue it. And he is just an extraordinary person and very open. The idea sort of came on the back of the film, really, to do something in terms of submarine volcanology, which is fascinating because there's so much we don't know. And the stuff he's doing out there is incredible, you know, and it's an opportunity for us to be able to open those doors for international students to come participate, but also for the local institute, again, to open their doors and build these sort of nice connections going forwards as well, which I think will hopefully help them to delve into different areas as well. So it works very well. And then, of course, there was the first Volcano Symposium, which, of course, was open access. And thank you very much for participating in that, Sam. You know,
no problem. I can provide links for that as well if anybody's. It was a very, very interesting day of basically a symposium, a small conference, very, very open, all around marine volcanism in the Canary Islands and the links to it. So there was aspects of physical oceanography, chemical oceanography, physical volcanology. There were some really interesting talks about actually old submarine lavas and volcanism and geology on the islands themselves. Not, you don't always have to go into the ocean to look for evidence of volcanoes in the ocean.
Yeah.
So it was just there was some wonderful presentations by current students,
yes,
as well as from local researchers and those coming in from outside as well. So it was a really, really wonderful day. And so you're actually repeating that again this year.
Yes, we are. And actually what was interesting about it is, you know, as a journalist, I always like to be a bit provocative, and we did a question and answer session, and you know, we asked some really tough questions, and we had a lot of the local and national institutions represented on the panel, and I'm just so grateful for them because they really stepped up, and some tough questions were asked, and they met them head on, and that's quite unusual, particularly in the territory where we're working, and we're just trying to encourage everybody to just be a bit braver. You know, because it's so easy to sort of sit behind your sort of ivory tower and do your lovely research and go home and think, great, I did this great paper or I did this great piece of whatever. But if it doesn't transcend that, if it doesn't get to the people, if it doesn't get applied, if it doesn't get put into context or used in a way that's helpful, you know, it's just always going to be an academic exercise. And it is difficult. I know it's difficult. I know people like to look to science for yes or no answers or 100% certainty. And we're operating in an area where there's a lot of grey areas still. But people understand that. You know, I think people are happier to hear, look, we don't have all the answers. I'm going to be honest with you. But this is what we do know. And this is possibly what could happen. And this is what you need to be thinking about. Rather than, oh, no, everything's fine. Don't worry. That's when people start to think, really?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So we need to build that trust. We need to make sure that we have messages that are coming out that are curated in a way that people connect with them. And always think of the people receiving that message first. Because what's the point of science if you're not doing it for the benefit of people? And if you're then not framing it in a way where they find it helpful, particularly in a territory which has natural hazards, and it's not just volcanoes in the Canary Islands, as we know. There's other hazards as well, as there are in other territories. And again, it comes back to receiving a mix of students from all over the world and showing them lava bombs has been really interesting. So one of my students from New Zealand was in tears and saying, you know, a lot of these lessons you're talking about, we learned 15 years ago in New Zealand. Why are these not being taught in schools in the Canary Islands? And I had another student from the Ethiopian Rift Zone, who was our scholar that year. And he said, oh my goodness, Sharon, we have so many natural hazards in Ethiopia. We haven't even begun to talk about this. I need to learn how to talk about this better. And we had another scholar from Colombia who said, I work with some indigenous communities and we've just been shouting at them and they're not listening. And suddenly I realized maybe we need to spend a bit more time going a bit more depth and see how we need to be talking about these subjects so that we connect with them and not just shout big sort of scary headlines at them when something is about to happen.
Yes, exactly.
So it's really interesting. Really,
because a headline doesn't always apply to all, and it rarely applies to all. It sometimes applies to the very few who maybe just want to see that big, bold headline, but it doesn't delve into, you know, the individual stories and the range of impacts, not just physically, but, you know, emotional, mental impacts that people go through. And I know that's been a large aspect of what you've covered within Lava Bombs and Volcano Stories as well, is that personal impacts of eruptions.
Absolutely. And that's huge. And the thing that really gets my goat is that a lot of it is preventable. You know, we didn't have anybody die directly from the volcano. Well, that's not strictly true, but that's another story. But so many people were impacted in so many ways that are preventable. And that's what's heartbreaking. So we're now doing Lava Bombs 2 on the reconstruction. And on the one hand, you have all the politicians, all the authorities talking about huge amounts of money that are being destined to La Palma. So, you know, that's generating a degree of frustration in some taxpayers saying, why are we sending so much money to La Palma? But then on the ground, you've got families who are still living in caravans because they don't have a response in terms of housing. You know, they're being asked to give one paper after another to show how many square meters they legally lived in, rather than recognize these people have had a really huge thing happen to them. And we need to make sure that they are, you know, that they are safe and make sure that they have somewhere decent to live and they can pay their food bills first and foremost. You know, so that's what's going to be one of the biggest messages of the film, is a volcano doesn't just kill people. You know, it completely transforms the terrain. And in a country where you have really complex laws around ownership and building and permits and all the rest of it and paperwork, you can't deal with an emergency of that scale as if it was just some other bureaucratic thing that you need to rubber stamp. You know, you need to recognize first and foremost that you have thousands of families who have been impacted and you need to give them a response immediately. And I don't care whether somebody had a palace or a flat or you know, I'm more interested in how we're going to support those families. And even in this day and age, because the official response at times was so slow to come, they were being pointed to charities like the church charity Caritas, you know, and they were picking up a lot of the slack. So when you talk to people like that and the work that they're doing in the community, it's really interesting because they will tell the unvarnished truth. And, you know, we have some very powerful interviews there as well that, you know, counterbalance what the official line is. And ironically, you know, most of the people we spoke to want to help. And most of the people want to feel that they're doing their best. But unless we're really honest about what's going wrong and what we haven't got right and what we can do better, you know, we're not going to improve. And, you know, from our point of view, we live in the Canary Islands. We've been having seismic activity over the years and stuff going on in Tenerife as well. And if we had an eruption in Tenerife, you wouldn't be speaking, you know, 7,000, 9,000 people being implicated. It could be 60,000. So if we're on this crusade, it's simply because we think we have to be a lot more honest and upfront about how we can improve, because there will be a next time. It might not be tomorrow, it might not be in 5 years, but it will happen. And we need to do better, because so much of the stress, anxiety and pain that families went through and are still going through is preventable. So why wouldn't you try and do better? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the biggest, literally, roadblocks, particularly on small volcanic islands, is physical access to areas, particularly for repairing communities. When you talk about the town was affected by the Tahoeate eruption, the road was physically cut off. And so then access to either side becomes a whole other logistical nightmare. And I imagine that is also responsible for a huge amount of recovery almost backlog, because yes, you can, you know, bulldoze through these roads, but you lose every single access point. Even from the ocean, it was not ideal to go around the area for quite some time. So it's that lifetime before response can begin as well.
Yeah. And I think, in a sense, the infrastructure is easier to address because you put some money in and you get the bulldozers out. And the bulldozers were incredible. The drivers, oh my goodness, they were crashing through that lava and it was still sort of blowing at points, you know. And that first road they cut across the lava was extraordinary. And again, a story that we'll be talking about in the film. But they've now built a second road. They're now planning a third road. And all of these roads will save 5-10 minutes. We're not talking a large area that's affected in terms of how long it takes you to drive. But they haven't built a single house. So why are you talking about building a third road? And the second road was meant to take thousands of vehicles a day. We've driven across it and maybe seen 2 or 3 cars. And that's when the other first road was closed for resurfacing. So you just think, you know, sometimes it's easier, you know, in an eruption, sometimes it's easier to talk about the hazard rather than the possible implications. So that's sometimes the default position, but it's not as helpful. And the recovery, it's easier to think about the infrastructure, to put up electricity poles, you know, and they're very proud about the new type of pole and the this and the that, and to build roads. But actually what people need is support for their families. What people need is a home. What people need is somebody sitting there listening to them, to what their actual concerns are. And there hasn't been enough of that in the first 2 years. I'm happy to say, I think that is beginning to change. They have a new president on the island who actually was a school teacher. And he was very implicated in his community. So he's really, really aware of the issues that need addressing. And it seems to me that things are starting to sort of unblock at the other end. But it's taken over 2 years, you know, it's just not right. It's just not right. You know, and if you have a country like Spain subfunding this recovery, we should have been further down the line by now. We really should. And just talking big sums of money and not listening to the people who are complaining is not the right way to go about it. And not all of these stories were portrayed in the press. So when we did the first lava bombs, we offered it to the local TV network and they refused to show it. You know, it was too controversial. But it's only 2 years. We then took it on the festival circuit because we wanted to reach different audiences. And we've been very lucky. We've been receiving lots of different prizes and accolades, which is great. But that's not what this is about. I just want these messages to be heard. And we took it to the festival, the Madrid International Festival in September, and it won Best Cinematography. So I then got back to the regional TV channel. I said, just so you know, this film you thought wasn't worth showing has won all of these prizes. Perhaps on the second anniversary, perhaps now would be a good time to show it. And to be fair, they did.
But I guess there's a question raised on how it then potentially implicates how media were showing stuff at the time. Because you were showing a completely different side of the story, but the real story.
Yeah. And, you know, it's no secret that or maybe it's not widely known, but newspapers locally are not particularly free, shall we say. There's a lot of things that we feel should be spoken about, which aren't. So that's why we've just started talking about things in the way we feel is a bit more helpful and tackling subjects which we think need to be addressed. So Lava Bombs 2 is again going to be pretty controversial, so it'd be interesting to see whether they show it or not, but you know, we'll get it seen one way or the other. And actually what we're starting to do now is tackle other subjects which we feel really passionately about. So going forwards, Volcano Stories is going to split into 3. So we'll still carry on our research in La Palma because there's still a lot of story to be told and to be followed and to be critical about, but also to lift up, amplify the stories which are good. You know, this isn't just a sort of bashing exercise. But then we're going to, with this summer, started looking at sustainable tourism in the Canary Islands because there's a lot of unrest over the direction of how that is going in the Canary Islands, and the some of the voices just are not being heard, so we want to make sure they are heard. And we've been preparing this report that we'll publish shortly and we've been having help from dozens of people on the ground, really incredible researchers, very passionate people who are actually very nervous about putting their name on the report. What does that tell you? What does that tell you? So they've been giving us all their knowledge and collaborating and all the rest of it. But that, yeah, but I can't actually sign this piece of paper to say that this is what I did. And I find that heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. So to my mind, I'll put my name on it, whatever. It doesn't matter. I just want that information out there. And I want people to have access to it. Because when you actually see what's been happening step by step by step by step, it's really shocking. It's really shocking.
And sometimes there's small little steps that happen over time rather than, you know, immediate big impacts that, you know, would make the headlines. It's that little bit of bureaucracy that just creeps its way in over time that just creates little barriers that eventually you realize, oh, this has actually become a significant impact.
Yeah. And actually, when you put all of that together, you think, good Lord, you know, it really is shocking. But it's only when you put it all down in black and white and you have it all together in one place that you really realize the scale of the thing. And we're talking about, you know, a world where that's worried about climate change, about temperatures. We've had record temperatures in the Canary Islands. The Canary Islands are an incredible destination, as I say, for endemic plants and creatures and nature. And just demolishing it and cementing it over and building one massive hotel after the other cannot be the answer. Particularly when you think that most people in the Canary Islands, locals, what benefit do they get from that? You know, it's one of the poorest areas in Spain. Think about that for a while. You know, the southern strip of Tenerife has got more five-star hotels per square kilometer than Madrid or Barcelona. Yet there's locals now living in tents, living in caravans because they can't afford to live in the towns that they used to live in. The locals are being sort of pushed away from the coastline and pushed up the hillside because no, that's tourist land. You know, that this is for the tourists. This is not your island anymore. This is tourist land. I don't think that's right. But it's a difficult area to step into because it's very political. But, you know, that's too bad. We have things to say and we'll say them.
Well, yeah, and then, so you've got the ability to do so, and you've been, you know, training these generations of people to speak honestly and to speak bravely about things they hear, not just as scientific researchers, but, you know, as through environmental protection, through sustainable practice, through showcasing people's lives and vulnerabilities on hazardous islands.
Yes, and that leads very neatly into our third pillar of Volcano Stories now, which is building volcanic resilience. So, again, we feel that there's a lot of areas we need to think about in terms of how we prepare people for a future, possible future eruption, however long or short that might be. And, of course, traditionally in the Canary Islands, we had this rather romantic view of volcanoes. You know, the volcanic eruption in 71 in La Palma was basically a tourist attraction. You know, Denegia erupted right next to the coast and people were like, oh, you know, and there was a tourism boom. But, of course, there's millions of people who visit the islands every year now. There's a big resident population and things are suddenly a lot more serious in that regard in terms of possible impacts. So, and again, it's a difficult area to step into, but I feel there's things that need to be spoken about and tackled head on. And one of them is just to be a lot more honest with the population and give them the right tools. So one of the things we're looking at is, you know, talking to people in La Palma, what would have helped you to know before an eruption? What would you tell people in other islands, you know? And I think doing the films, doing the research, doing it in this way keeps it in people's minds, not because you have to live in fear the whole time, that's not right. You know, they're beautiful, glorious islands, which we love living in and we invest in and we adore. But you also have to know where you're living. You know, these are volcanic islands and there's things you need to be aware of. So we feel there's still a lot of work to do in that regard. So we're working very closely with IGN, the National Geographic Institute. They're doing some incredible work now as well. And we want to, you know, help as best we can with that as well. The Oceanographic Institute is doing some incredible research, which is beautiful because they're communicating about it in a way which, you know, people hadn't heard before. So when everybody was worried about the marine life in La Palma and, oh my gosh, this is going to be disaster, lava going to sea, it's going to kill the animals. And actually what they're seeing is something completely different. You know, there's been an extraordinary bloom. El Hierro now is extraordinary what's happened because of the Tagoro volcano. And they're starting to talk about that now. And I went onto the boat, I think it was in February. So literally just 6 weeks after the eruption had finished, and they were bringing up samples from the seabed, and it already had little bits of algae growing on it. And you think, nature is incredible, you know.
And the fish just went away. It's the other
side of things, isn't it? No, I know. And the fish went away when things started, and then they came back. And you just think, you know, we're the ones who mess this up. Not nature is just very wise. Nature is wise, you know. We have a lot to learn, I think.
And all this, the building of the programs is also allowing you to kind of build the interns and the training programs along with it, because you can involve them in these contemporary current issues. And also, I imagine it changes what you see as your needs for the internship. Okay, so we're going down this area of volcano resilience. We can actually start training people already to think about these things.
Yes, and it's also so rich because they all have their own views, opinions, experiences to bring to the table. And I think the way I like to run Geo Tenerife is that me as a person, I'm not important. I'm just a connector. And the sum of everything we do is so much greater than any of its moving parts, because we absorb the best of everybody and then push that forward, you know? And I think that's what makes us a bit different to other companies maybe working the space or other science outfits. And it's allowed us to really react to things in a way which I think is very difficult for people who solely rely on public funding to do. So we can sort of turn on a dime, really, if we feel there's something that we need to address. And it's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. But at the center of everything, it's always thinking about people first, you know, and how we can do better by people living in these extraordinary areas.
Wonderful. Well, if you're somebody who is potentially interested in this, I would certainly consider you to look at Geo Tenerife program, to ask questions, because I've, like I said at the beginning, I've only heard good things, and it's continuing to evolve and grow in different directions over these years. So it's really, really fantastic work you've been doing in that regard. And so just something to finish up, I know we could keep talking about these subjects for a long, long time, and we will do. We always will continue to do so. But something for you personally, you know, obviously you've spent so much time on the Canary Islands, but is there a particular moment or memory, maybe not regarding the Canary Islands, something about volcanoes that always just sticks with you?
Well, actually, it's something a lot more recent. There's lots of historic things, but yeah, I've just come back from holiday in Italy. We were south of Naples, and of course, there's a lot of headlines going around while we were there about super volcano and Cap Fregare, and you know, it was the biggest, most terrible, most this, and it could be this. And it just shocked me how we're still so bad at helping people to decipher what's going on in their territory. And if we leave it to the journalists, I mean, I was a journalist for 20 years, you know, journalists are looking for a headline. If we leave it to journalists to get our messages across, and the journalists haven't got the sort of background in giving the right context, you know, the messages are going to be a little warped. And we met so many people who were anxious, who didn't know what to do. And of course, there are no easy answers, because we don't know what could happen, when it could happen, how big or small it could be, how it could impact. But there are messages we need to be thinking about and helping people with. And I think we just need to do better. We really need to do better. And I encourage anybody who's working in this sort of area in terms of mitigating risk, volcanoes, any other side of natural hazards, whatever work you do, remember you're working for people. There's people who are affected by this. And everything that you talk about, that you publish, focus on the people and how they're impacted, because that has to be, and it's right, it has to be our primary concern.
Well, I can't actually think of a better closing line for not just this episode, but for this series there. So thank you for delivering that. Because I think in the first series, we spoke a lot about kind of like nature, and a lot about art and exploration around volcanoes and kind of like that wonder factor. But this second series, a lot of the other episodes have focused on, like I said, education, communication, storytelling, but also journalism and media, and what they all have in common are people.
Yes.
And that's what we're trying to do in our own regards, but also, you know, with this podcast as well, is showcase how volcanoes interact with their societies that surround them, and how the societies interact with the geohazards and the environment that they're in.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you for that, Sam. Thank you for all the work that you do, because you're so dynamic and you really shine a light on areas in a novel way, an exciting way, and a way that people really connect with. And I think that's so important. So keep going.
Cool. Well, you too as well. So thank you so much for joining us today, Sharon. I really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody listening. This will be wrapping up this series now of Volcanology, and there'll be a slightly different spin of topics coming for the next one. Exactly when that is, we'll find out in the future. But I'll just give a final thank you to Sharon and all of our guests for this series. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam.